Come to order. Today is March 11th, 2009. Open a work session on House Bill 2344.
House Bill 2344 requires that sexually explicit property or material involving a victim of criminal conduct remain in the control of law enforcement agency or the court throughout the criminal proceeding. We have a minimal fiscal impact statement and no revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2344 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wissner moves House Bill 2344 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Representative Barton.
And Mr. Chair, I am planning to vote no in this committee. With that said, I am actually planning to vote yes on the floor. The reason for that is I support this bill. I support the intent of it. I happen to think that a Dash 5 amendment might be appropriate, and by my no vote, I'm trying to signal that to our colleagues in the Senate.
Thank you, Representative Barton. Any further discussion? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the same view as Representative Barton. I'll be a no vote. I'm undecided about the floor vote. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
No.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Does Sager want to carry it?
Representative Gelser will be the carrier. Thank you. Okay. All right. No. Musical legal counsel today. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2584.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2584 allows a plaintiff to bring an antitrust lawsuit if they are an indirect purchaser. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Phil Donovan and Tina Bentley Walters. Betty Walters.
I haven't decided yet.
Upside down.
Upside down.
That's fine for me.
Shows you that I better stay in this career than.
Not overwhelming you, Representative Shields. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2584. With me is Tina Beatty Walters, who is going to provide a comprehensive overview of the legislation that's before you, a little bit of its history, what we believe to be the practical effects, and she'll be covering the materials that have been distributed to you. We've had conversations about this legislation, and you all understand that the Oregon legislature tried to balance an injustice in 2001 when it passed a partial repeal of Illinois BRIC. In effect, the legislature was asking the Attorney General to stand up for indirect purchasers in antitrust litigation. We are here to explain how those goals have not been met. Oregon's Attorney General does not have the resources to evaluate and participate in antitrust litigation. They are without the staffing. They have many functions to pursue and consider antitrust litigation across the country. And given the fiscal condition of the state, the lack of resources is likely to get worse. In other words, current law is not working towards a fair and competitive marketplace and fails to look out for the interests of Oregonians and the businesses that they own. A change of law is needed and will provide more effective enforcement of antitrust laws without costing the state more money. And in a subtle attempt at humor, based on my conversation with Representative Barton walking in. I would ask that you hold your questions until we've had an opportunity to kind of go through the materials that's before you, mostly because your fervent line of questioning scares me. But fortunately, the pregnant woman to my right is not. So with that, I would turn it over to Tina.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Tina Beatty Walters. I'm an attorney from Portland. I practice with the firm Stoll, Stolburn, Lochting, and Schlachter. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2584. House Bill 2584 is what is commonly referred to as an Illinois BRIC repealer. Illinois BRIC is a 1977 United States Supreme Court decision that restricted the right to bring suit and recover damages for antitrust injuries to direct purchasers only. And I want to explain that a little bit by going through the graphic that I've put together. There's a graphic in front of you up on a board, and hopefully you can all see that. But if not, there is the same graphic is represented behind tab one in the materials that I've submitted today. So if you can look at that, that would be great. The graphic really illustrates the holding of Illinois BRIC. And basically, to go through this a little bit, you have a chain of distribution for most products in the United States. You have manufacturers at the top of the chain. Now, if you have price fixing or some sort of anti-competitive conduct like that among a couple of manufacturers, for example, in this example, you've got a conspiracy to fix prices between a couple of manufacturers. As a result of that, the prices of the goods that they're selling are artificially inflated because of the violation of antitrust law there. The direct purchasers of those products are wholesalers or distributors. Now, under the United States Supreme Court decision of Illinois BRIC, only those direct purchasers of products from the manufacturers have the right to bring suit and recover injuries for that antitrust conduct. But unfortunately, what happens most of the time is that the direct purchasers, who are the wholesalers or the distributors, have the ability to pass on the unlawful overcharges because they are reselling those products. So the wholesalers might sell the products to retailers who then might sell them again to other businesses or consumers. And so often what happens is the overcharge gets passed on down the distribution chain. Under Illinois BRIC, only the direct purchasers, again, can file suit against the violators of antitrust law. And what we're talking about here is really that the retailers and the consumers and businesses at the end of the chain of distribution have no remedy against the violators of antitrust law. So they have no remedy against the manufacturers who conspired to fix prices. And that's really what we're here to talk about. One of the problems created by Illinois BRIC is that the wholesalers and the distributors, the direct purchasers, often have no incentive to sue the conspiring price-fixing manufacturers because they have a direct business relationship with them, and that could hurt their business relationship. So that's another problem created by the law or the decision. So many states have rectified the injustices created under their own antitrust laws. They've rectified the injustices created by Illinois BRIC. 23 states currently provide indirect purchasers with standing to bring suit against the antitrust violators for their own injuries. 17 of those states allow the plaintiff to recover treble, which means triple, damages under their antitrust laws. And you can find a listing and a description of the state's laws behind tab 4 in my materials. The 2001 Oregon legislature recognized that the rule of Illinois BRIC would be unfair to Oregonians. That legislature enacted a partial repealer of Illinois BRIC that allowed the Attorney General only to bring suit on behalf of consumers only, not businesses. I'm here today to explain why the 2001 partial repealer is simply insufficient and leaves too many Oregonians without remedies for their injuries. And I've also submitted with my materials two letters in support of House Bill 2584 that I would encourage you to review. One is from Professor of Law Ed Burnett, and the other from practicing attorney Gary Grenley. Both have nearly 30 years of experience in the antitrust field, and they were sorry that they couldn't make it here today to testify. You can find those letters behind tab 2B and tab 5 of my materials. There are currently 71 separate consolidated antitrust cases pending in the United States. And you can find that behind tab 6, the listing of consolidated antitrust cases. These are cases that have been consolidated together by the multi-district litigation panel. Each one of these 71 cases consists of a number of cases that were separately filed around the country against the same defendants that have been consolidated together in one forum for all discovery and pretrial purposes. Now, cases can be consolidated by the multi-district litigation panel if there are common issues of fact and law. And it's very common when cases are filed around the country against the same defendants alleging the same facts or involving the same sort of transactions that the defendants will ask to have the cases consolidated by the MDL panel. And that's very common, and it happens all the time. Back to the 71. The Oregon DOJ couldn't begin to evaluate 71 open antitrust cases. They just don't have the resources. I'm not here to knock the Oregon Attorney General at all. They do fantastic work with the resources that they have. There's no question about that. But the Oregon Department of Justice right now has, as I understand it, two or possibly less than two full-time equivalent attorneys handling all of the state's antitrust business. There are currently two pieces of pending antitrust indirect purchaser litigation on file by the Oregon Attorney General right now. They are investigating, as I understand, a number of others, but there are only two on file right now. I have two examples to help illustrate why Illinois BRIC is still a problem for Oregon consumers and businesses today. I want to talk a little bit about the vitamins case. The vitamins case helped convince the 2001 legislature to enact a partial repealer, but it also demonstrates why the partial repealer is inadequate. The vitamins case was a consolidated case on behalf of indirect purchasers and others against the six major manufacturers of vitamins that were used in other products and sold as vitamin pills. The allegations were that the six major manufacturers that controlled 80% of the market for vitamins met in secret for over a decade to fix the prices of their products and to control supply by establishing sales volumes in different geographic territories. Now, as a result of this conduct, the prices of their products were artificially high. The vitamins sold by these companies were used in products such as milk, in bread, animal feed, and sold as vitamin pills. So a massive nationwide settlement was reached with the six vitamin manufacturers, and that was in the amount of $305 million. The settlement funds were directed to consumers, to farmers, and to grocery store owners who paid higher prices for vitamins and vitamin-containing products than they otherwise would have, absent the price fixing. Oregonians from the settlement received nothing. Now, the settlement was reached prior to the 2001 partial repealer, so there was not an opportunity at that point for the Attorney General to join. Washingtonians received from the settlement $10,806,000 because it, at the time, was a repealer state. Significantly, over $3 million of that $10 million that went to Washington was earmarked for the farmers and the retailers who paid too much for vitamin-containing products. Businesses in Oregon, of course, received nothing. Now, if that type of settlement were to happen again today under current law, businesses in Oregon would again receive nothing. Oregon's repealer does not allow businesses to recover damages, even if they can prove they suffer damages as a result of the price fixing of the manufacturers. The second example I have for you today is the Relafen case. Relafen is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug that is used to treat pain and inflammation and things such as arthritis. Now, the allegations in the case were that the manufacturers of the drug created a monopoly in the market for that particular drug. What they did is they committed fraud in securing a patent for the drug, and then they used FDA procedures and completely unmeritorious litigation filed against its competitors to prevent the generic version of the drug from being marketed. Once the patent was invalidated due to the fraud, antitrust suits were filed by, among other things, indirect purchasers around the country. As is typical, the cases were all consolidated by the MDL panel into one forum. In 2005, a $75 million settlement was reached with the indirect purchasers and approved by the federal court to whom all the cases were assigned. The settlement monies were distributed based entirely upon the state that a consumer lived in when the consumer purchased the drug. Now, the judge approving the settlement made it very clear that the settlement must treat consumers from repealer states very differently from the way it treats consumers from non-repealer states. This is because only consumers from repealer states have the right to recover as indirect purchasers under their state's laws. Now, the settlement was structured such that repealer state consumers would receive 82.5% of their purchase price for Relafen over the claims period. Consumers from non-repealer states, of which Oregon is one, would receive only 9.2% of the cost of their purchases for Relafen over the same period. Now, to give you a concrete example of what that might look like for a consumer who spent $300 over the class period for Relafen would be entitled to a $247.50 refund in a repealer state, but only a $27.60 refund if in a non-repealer state, including Oregon. And I have a portion of the opinion, the judge's opinion behind tab 7. This is the opinion approving the Relafen settlement, and I've highlighted some of the pertinent portions that you might want to look at. And also, I neglected to mention about the vitamin settlement. I included behind tab 3 the Washington Attorney General's announcement of the settlement. Oregonians paid the same unlawfully high prices for Relafen that consumers in repealer states did, but Oregonians were effectively prevented from fully recovering for their injuries. And Oregonians can expect to be treated like this again in future cases. They have no rights right now, except for cases in which the Attorney General pursues an indirect purchaser action on their behalf. And Oregonians have no rights at all if their injuries are to their businesses. The 2001 partial repealer is a good first step, but it's not the solution Oregonians need. The question in front of you now is, what is Oregon public policy? Is it to protect from liability the monopolistic price fixers, or is it to protect Oregonians who are injured by them? Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions from the panel? For the panel, rather. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you. I was writing. I didn't want to embarrass myself. I was going to ask counsel, what's triple damages?
Double damages?
So if it's $1,000, if you've lost $1,000, you get $3,000.
Yeah. Good deal. I have some questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please.
Thank you. Thank you for coming by my office ahead of time, and I noticed you added into your book the charts from what other states and how they've treated this. I think, Mrs. Beatty Waters, the questions I have is, we're going through this lawsuit, and at the bottom of the day, that a consumer who this bill is intended to help may get back $300. Is that correct? And how does he enter into the tort suit? How much is that going to cost the consumer? And is that going to drive up the cost of the goods $300 to increase the liability insurance of other similar products?
Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant, thank you for the question. That's a good question. See if I can answer, and please let me know if I don't. The $300 example was just an example I kind of pulled out of thin air. I think it entirely depends on the facts of the case, what the damages are to each individual consumer and business. There may be cases where the damages are much more significant. You asked about how a consumer might get involved or how a person might get involved in a case like this.
The cost.
The way, if I can explain, cases are filed, typically a consumer or a business who discovers they've been the subject of an antitrust injury, has an antitrust damage, might file a case here on their own behalf in Oregon under Oregon law if this bill were to pass. In Oregon, under Oregon law, for their own damages on their own behalf and perhaps on behalf of others similarly situated to them, so perhaps on behalf of other consumers or other businesses that are situated similarly to them. And then what's likely to happen is that the defendant almost certainly has been sued in other states, and the cases are often consolidated together, and I think what I referred to before is the multi-district litigation procedure in one court, and then they're handled pretty efficiently all together, consolidated, rather than having cases going on all around. Typically, they're all consolidated together and handled together for pretrial purposes, and most often cases like this are settled. That's most often the case. And what happens in terms of costs and attorney fees is that the attorney fees basically are what normally takes place is that if a common fund is created in a piece of class action litigation, the attorney fees are taken out of the common fund as a percentage, and then the remainder is distributed to the injured parties. And those arrangements are always, the attorney fees are always approved by the court. That's a requirement under the class action rules.
Chair, go ahead. If I could, just one important point I think needs to be made, Chair Barker, Representative Wisnant. An important goal of antitrust law is deterrence, hence trouble damages.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I understand that, but I'm still struggling with the concept here. And as we had our meeting in my office, so we're talking about usually low for the consumer. It's not a normal cases that you've cited here. It's not a significant amount. And the only way it becomes a bigger amount is if you get all the group together and you have litigation. You're saying now that the I get my $300 back because I was overcharged for vitamins, you know, that I'm not going to have to pay $600 for legal expenses. I hear you're saying that that's going to come out. But how you track the increase in value, I'm not sure. And I guess the other question I would have, changing subjects a little bit, is the Attorney General, when did they take on this responsibility? And again, very well presented, but I'm afraid I didn't have time to go through much of this. I was looking at some of the things, and the example you gave on the first example, Oregon came out better than Washington State on the $30 million about the vitamins with the Attorney General handling the case. So my question is, you know, have we given the Attorney General a fair chance to represent the consumers and look after the consumers without changing the procedure we have now to...
Let me comment on that last portion, and I'm sorry if my materials were unclear. There was a $305 million settlement with indirect purchasers, and that's what Washingtonians participated in to the tune of $10,800,000. Oregonians couldn't participate in that because they didn't have any type of repealer on the books at the time. What they did participate in was a separate and much smaller settlement for state purchases. So there were direct purchases, and that settlement totally was $30 million. What Oregon received is $78,000 from that $30 million settlement. That was the full amount of the settlement, $30 million.
And do you think, Mr.
Go ahead, please.
And do you think the Attorney General's had time to really prove that this doesn't protect the consumers, that we're going to change the system? When was that enacted? Let's hope that our economic situation short-term might... I don't have 25 years to come out of this recession.
Representative Wisnant, my understanding is that since 2001, mm-hmm. since the partial repealer has passed, the Attorney General has had no more than three, and sometimes, as right now, less than two full-time equivalent attorneys doing all of the antitrust business of the state, only part of which is pursuing cases on behalf of consumers as indirect purchasers. I think Mr. Albertine is going to be testifying after me, and he actually was the chief antitrust enforcer for the state for quite a period of time, and we'll be able to identify what it is, you know, what other matters, the antitrust matters the Attorney General does handle, but I understand that there's a significant addition. There's a whole, you know, other component of antitrust work that the Attorney General handles. So it's not likely there's going to be a huge ability to handle a lot more of these types of cases in the near future.
Sure, thank you.
Please.
You've made a great presentation, and I appreciate all the work. And I guess my concern is I want to be sure the consumer is being protected. I'm not sure in the long run if we start adding, you know, more liability insurance for the consumer, the price, if we're talking about small settlements here, that's going to really benefit. I'm sure it'll help, you know, stimulate the business for lawyers, and we have a very qualified lawyers on this committee that may be, you know, out there looking for additional work. But Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Stigler.
Just to be really clear here, what this does not do is take away from the Attorney General the ability to pursue these cases as well, correct?
Representative Stigler, that's correct.
Okay, and I just want to, so that option is still in the mix. The Attorney General is still able to pursue those in those situations that the Attorney General might deem appropriate and falling within their, you know, staffing abilities, those kind of things.
Absolutely.
But what this does is open it up for the individual consumers to be able to redress some of the wrongs potentially done to them as well. It gives options.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and Representative Stigler, if I could also respond in the sense that I want to make clear to the committee that in cases of antitrust litigation, consumers aren't going to pursue retailers or retailers aren't going to pursue wholesalers or distributors. This is all about the conspiracy that occurs at the manufacturer's level. So it's quite focused in that regard as it relates to antitrust litigation.
Any further questions?
No,
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you just pointed to that. It says that there are no remedies for retailers or consumers today. Isn't there remedies through the Attorney General's office?
Representative Cameron, only if only for consumers, not for businesses. Retailers and other businesses have no remedies right now, if they're not direct purchasers. If they directly purchase from a manufacturer who violates the antitrust laws, they do have a remedy, but not if they're indirect purchasers. If they purchase through a wholesaler, a distributor, or some other business, they have no remedy right now.
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, to that end, I believe you were outside of the room when we were talking a bit about a antitrust litigation that was determined, called a vitamins case, in which case, in the state of Washington, not only were consumers covered in the settlement, but also Eastern Washington farmers who had been hurt and retailers in Washington State. And our point had been that in Oregon, even if the Attorney General had participated in that case, under the current law, those farmers, those businesses would not have been covered, only the consumers.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tina or Phil, either one of you can answer the question. But this is kind of a spinoff of what Representative Stigler asked you. Why would you want to have both the Attorney General's office have the ability to pursue this as well as the consumer? I mean, I guess I'm, it almost kind of looks like it's, you know, a double bang type of thing.
Representative Barker, Representative Olson, I don't think that there would be simultaneous actions by individuals in Oregon and the Attorney General. And perhaps Mr. Albertine can answer this a little better than I can about how this works in other repealer states, but my understanding is that generally the Attorney General's action, if there is one, gets some priority and some preference. So if there are other actions filed, it's the Attorney General's action that, assuming it's filed in a timely way, and, you know, the other cases, if there are other cases filed by Oregonians aren't, just before trial or something, I mean, I would assume that the Attorney General's action is going to have priority if there is one.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, don't we have several examples in the law where there are public rights of action and also private rights of action, where we can, we being the state, can go in and meddle, but that doesn't eliminate the ability. I mean, heck, OJ, we tried to put him in jail, but he was still allowed to be sued. I mean, isn't that relatively common? And if it's not, if you can give us examples, that might be helpful.
Yeah, Chair Barker and Representative Smith, that's a very good point. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act is one example where the Attorney General has authority to pursue violators under that statute, but there's also a private right of action on behalf of consumers who are injured by, misrepresentations in buying consumer products. So that's one example.
Thank you.
Plus OJ.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Chair Barker. In a second, I want to ask you about how, the famous ADM case might have affected small businesses in Oregon. But before I ask you that question, I just wanted to make
the comment is the chair of Public Safety Sub, where we struggle with the budget in the Department of Justice. We're under an incredible amount of pressure to make sure that they have enough funds to defend very serious criminal convictions. And I think what I've seen as two cycles of looking at their budget is that there's just not enough resources there for them to do the work that they need to be doing. Protecting consumers, and we don't have in this country basically the regulatory framework in order to make sure these things aren't happening, the investigative reach. So I think at the end of the day, what we're left with is people's ability to take action to defend themselves in the courts. But could you go back to the ADM antitrust case and maybe indicate to us how that might have played out in Oregon? Are you fairly familiar with it?
I'm actually not Chair Barker, Representative Shields. I'm not exactly sure which case you're referring to.
The price-fixing case that Archer Daniels Midland was involved in back in, I think, early 2000.
I'm not exactly sure what the outcome of that case was.
Well, I was just, my assumption is that it would have really stung a lot of small business retailers who were involved in the food processing and in farming, and so I just wanted to get that point clarified.
Right.
Something we can follow up on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Everteen, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Andy Albertine. I am an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I was a former assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice from 1989 to 2003, at which time I was one of the lead antitrust lawyers for the state of Oregon. I was one of the attorneys who assisted former Attorney General Hardy Myers in presenting the amendments to the Illinois BRIC bill in 2001. So I have some familiarity with the background and the way in which the bill went through the legislature. I was also involved in an interim study committee after the bill was passed, which led to a report dated February 24th, 2003. And I'm here in part to answer questions if anyone has questions about either of those processes. I believe that Ms. Beatty-Walters has done an excellent job of describing the background of Illinois BRIC, the purpose and effect of it, as well as the purpose and effect of this bill. I wish to spend some time focusing on a couple of key points, in my view, as to why I support this bill. It comes down to two issues for me. One is, does the Attorney General's Office have the resources and the capacity to handle all indirect purchaser cases on behalf of consumers and government agencies? And my answer is no. And the reason I answer it that way is because I've been there. I have seen all of the work that the Attorney General must do for the state's antitrust business. And if you'll allow me for just a moment to explain what that might be. That includes providing all antitrust to state agencies who come and ask for that. As this committee well knows, the Oregon Attorney General is the lawyer for the state. And as such, when state agencies come and ask for any type of advice or seeks work in the antitrust arena, it is the Attorney General who must respond. That is not an insignificant task. Secondly, the Attorney General is responsible for all statewide actions, we call them local actions, where there is no other government agency at the federal level that would be investigating these types of cases. Third, merger enforcement. Since about the mid-1990s, the state of Oregon has been involved in merger reviews enforcements when the proposed merger has threatened to impact negatively the interest of businesses or consumers. Merger enforcement is an extremely resource-intensive action where sometimes a single or two lawyers can be put into that case to the exclusion of all other cases for up to 6, 9 months, or even a year at a time. Then you get to the litigation involving multi-state, some of which relate to injunctive relief, others which relate to damages. By the time you put all of that together, you can see that having only 2 full-time attorneys assigned to all of that work, it is simply insufficient to ask the Attorney General, it's unfair to ask the Attorney General, to handle all of that work on behalf of indirect purchasers. Now, as a 13-year veteran of the Attorney General's office, I'm the first one, and I will always be the first one, to hold up the Oregon Attorney General as one of the best examples of state government enforcement in the country. I was very proud to serve there, and I'm still proud to say that I was there. But the reality is, and having seen what is out there in the last 5-plus years as a lawyer in private practice, they can't do it. So what that means is, when you're talking about consumer remedies, the Attorney General only is the one and only stop to ensure that consumers have their day in court. And if the resources are inadequate, the consumers will not have their day in court. Now, what you're going to hear from members who oppose this bill are there other means, specifically to hire what are called special assistant attorneys general. That is hiring members from the private bar under the guise and under the supervision of the Attorney General's office. It's a complicated process. It doesn't always work out. And it just adds another layer of regulatory review and time and expense for the Attorney General's office that is not, in my view, necessary. And I say this knowing that I have myself been an assistant, a special assistant attorney general hired by other states in the past to handle merger reviews, such as for the state of Nevada. At times, it is a very effective tool to add to the resources on a temporary basis, on a case-by-case basis, and I'm a living example of that. But for the long-term fix, it doesn't resonate with me that this is something that can be done and should be done. Now, as to the issue of indirect purchaser businesses, I think that the first two speakers up here did a fine job of explaining that at this point the businesses have no remedy whatsoever. Even though the Attorney General can bring an action, it is limited to consumers and government agencies. Now, why is that? In part, because in 2001, that particular standing, that particular class of purchasers, that standing was taken out of the bill early on. And as a result, once it was determined that the Attorney General would be the only one authorized to bring an action, as I've indicated in my written testimony, it didn't make a lot of sense to charge the Attorney General with representing businesses as well, because you can foresee a conflict of interest situation quite easily, where you could see that the Attorney General would be representing businesses at one level of the chain of distribution and perhaps consumers at another level of the chain of distribution. And that had always been a concern in the Attorney General's office. More importantly, we get back to the resource. We swing back to that. And if the resources aren't sufficient to handle consumer actions, it certainly wouldn't be sufficient to handle consumer and business actions. Now, you saw the chart. And the chart is very clear that this bill is not aimed at adding business expenses or costs to small businesses in the state of Oregon. We all know that Oregon's business community is still made up primarily of small and mid-sized businesses. And small and mid-sized businesses typically are not the manufacturers. They are typically the ones who are the distributors, the wholesalers, the retailers. And as such, when you have a case from the top down where the overcharge is at the top and it's passed through, the cost is incurred by the business. It is a cost incurred by the business that business must absorb. It increases the cost to Oregon businesses to do their job. They cannot recover that cost from the businesses that engaged in the unlawful actions. And I'm prepared to answer the question about insurance, and I will be happy to do that. But the fact is, the cost to Oregon businesses is one that must be absorbed. That's real. And those who violate the law, if they pay as a result of multi-state actions that result in settlement, those damages will be paid to other businesses in other states, not in Oregon. So I view this, frankly, as a pro-business bill for small businesses in the state of Oregon who otherwise have no remedy whatsoever. I view it as an opportunity for businesses in Oregon to have their day in court. I view it as a fundamental principle that all Oregon consumers, all Oregon businesses, ought to have their day in court to redress injuries when others have violated the law so that they can compete on a level playing field. I also view it as pro-business for those manufacturers and wholesalers who do follow the law and who do wish to play by the rules, and as a result, who are willing to spend that additional money if necessary, or at least forego ill-gotten gains in order to play by the rules and to compete fairly. And when we don't have a system that adequately deters and punishes those who are getting away with more money than they should because there isn't an adequate remedy, that rewards the large businesses, and it compromises their competitors and small businesses. And that's why it's pro-business. It's also a law enforcement technique. The antitrust laws from the very beginning, the private right of remedy was designed to make sure that lawyers and consumers and businesses were the private attorney generals. That's a concept that you see in case law, private attorney general. And it is designed to send a signal to businesses who are considering violating the laws to don't do it because the stakes are high. Yes, the costs of litigation are high, but the stakes are high as well. And if you get caught, you will pay. And the more people out there who can honorably enforce the law in a way that is consistent with the federal and state rules and statutes and the guidelines and the policies of the federal and state court system, that's when you have true justice. And that's when you have deterrence being carried out by members of the private sector. And that's what this bill is about. I am happy at this point to entertain any questions that anyone might have.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Albertine, I think you may encounter some concern from some members of the committee based on the questions that's been asked about, does this create a risk of duplicative causes of action running against companies at the same time so that you have a risk of being hit with multiple damages for the same wrongful act? Could you say more about how these things work and why that's how that plays out?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, members of the committees, I would be happy to. First, it is my view that concerns about duplicative causes of actions are largely illusory. And the reason I say that is because what generally happens is, and I think the question was asked before, how do consumers get to litigation in the first instance? And in the overwhelming majority of instances, these are in class actions. What happens in the process is that actions involving indirect purchasers at one level and maybe direct purchasers at another level are generally consolidated and in related cases. And as a result of that, you will have either one judge possibly handling all of the litigation, or you will have a related litigation to where the courts are mindful of what is happening in each litigation. Now, as a result of that, the each plaintiff class in the level of distribution must demonstrate their own damages. And you will have economists who will be hired by these different plaintiffs groups to describe exactly what damages they suffered. And if you have plaintiffs at more than one level in the chain of distribution, their economists must factor in what types of damages were passed through to the next level in the chain of distribution. So in terms of risking duplicative damages recoveries, that shakes out in related case actions. It certainly shakes out in the overwhelming instances where there are settlements involved. I have never seen a settlement where there has been more than a dollar-for-dollar recovery. In other words, I have never personally seen a settlement where treble damages were paid as a result of the settlement, and the overwhelming majority of cases do settle. So what ends up happening at the end of the day is that more cases are not filed. There are enough indirect purchaser statutes in other cases to where indirect purchaser actions are going to happen. Whatever this legislature does on this bill, those actions will still occur because there are enough indirect purchaser actions in other states for indirect purchaser actions to continue. What this bill will allow is if within the context of the actions that are already in play and those that will be in play in the future, Oregonians now have a chance to join in terms of the litigation or in the settlement. And I hope I've answered your question, Representative Garrett. If I haven't, I'd be happy to add to it.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, Andy, thanks for sharing. You've shed some light for me on this whole thing. Should this House bill pass, what kind of a caseload do you see for the courts on something like this?
I don't see a significantly increased caseload in the courts, certainly in the state of Oregon, because most of the cases that are filed are national-based cases, class action cases that have national base. And so you will see Oregonians and Oregon businesses oftentimes represented in a national class action. I personally am involved in a case. I do not represent indirect purchasers, but direct purchasers, and it's not atypical for cases to be filed in other jurisdictions, such as in the Northern District of California. There could be, and I will concede, and I think it's important to concede this, that if there is an indirect purchaser action that where the unlawful conduct and the damages are limited to the geography of the state of Oregon and not outside the state of Oregon, you would see that case being filed in the circuit courts in Oregon, and you would see an increase there. I would say, based on my experience, not a substantial increase.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So something just occurred to me, and make sure I'm right about it. So right now, an Oregon business can be sued, and I may be wrong about this, which is why I'm asking it, that an Oregon business could be sued, and non-Oregon or non-Oregonians could receive remedies as indirect purchasers.
Yes.
But a non-Oregon or Oregon company, which was sued, couldn't be sued by Oregonian plaintiffs, and those Oregonians couldn't receive remedy.
If the Oregonian is a business, the answer is yes. And the assumption on all of your hypotheticals, Representative Smith, is that the unlawful action carried across state borders where there was damages contained suffered from that. But with that clarification, the answers are yes.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next, Mr. Gardner, Mr. Holt, and Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Microsoft and Pharma. And I must admit to some claim of paternity with regard to the current version of the statute, because together with AOI, I was part of the group that worked with Andy to fashion the compromise that was intended to address the particular problem that was presented to the 2001 session. And that problem really was that the state in these multi-state settlements was not participating to the degree that other neighboring states were. And what we were striving to do was to develop a a compromise approach that would mitigate the risk, and we do perceive that there is a significant risk of duplicative recovery, of essentially transforming treble damages exposure into, to use this example, ninefold damage exposure to the manufacturer, to mitigate that risk, but at the same time to allow the state to participate fully in these multi-state settlements, such as the vitamins case. And the way that we attempted to accomplish that objective was to allow the Attorney General, in what is called his parens patriae capacity, to basically represent that group of direct and indirect consumers, and then to allow the Attorney General to fashion relief through CyPrate recoveries, which are recoveries that are intended to benefit the public as a whole by, for instance, donating the proceeds to a charity that would address, in the case, let's take of ADM, a food overcharge, the food bank, or something on that order. And as Andy mentioned, after the 2001 session, I and a number of other folks, some of whom are now presented to you, Andy, Ed Burnett, we participated in an interim group, and we looked very carefully at exactly the issue that is posed by House Bill 2584, and it was a balanced group. It was folks on the plaintiff side, folks on the defense side. I think we had Barnes Ellis from Stoll Reeves and a number of people. Ed Burnett was a member of that group. And at the end of the day, the group looked at some interesting concepts that might mitigate the risk of duplicative recovery. For instance, under the federal antitrust laws, which does not allow indirect purchaser standing, there is a prohibition on what's called a passing on defense, and that's really aimed at sort of putting in concrete the idea that you can't get those multiples of treble damages award, and we really couldn't figure out a good way of codifying that. So at the end of the day, the group could not agree on an expansion of the sort that 2584 represents, and essentially left the law alone in its post 2001 session version. And I would suggest to you that there is there are certainly arguments on the pro side, but there are also arguments on the status quo side. I think in this kind of circumstance, the Attorney General really can better prioritize and consolidate the interests of consumers. The Attorney General can recover attorney's fees under the antitrust law, and can fashion remedies that are, I would suggest, often better able to benefit consumers through the CyPrey doctrine. Often in a private antitrust class action, the remedy for the consumer will consist of coupons. And ironically, the coupons will often be to subsidize the cost of the product of the antitrust defender, which is a kind of a perverse result that Ed Burnett has actually written law review articles about complaining about that practice. And as Andy also mentioned, the Attorney General is not without resources in terms of chasing down these claims. If there is not sufficient in-house staff, the SAG approach or Special Attorney General approach is certainly available, and there are plenty of qualified folks like Andy Aubertin who the state can turn to for assistance in these cases. So I would suggest that is a factor that certainly with a very new and activist Attorney General, we ought to see exactly what the options might be. Finally, a point was made about businesses down the chain, the retailers down the chain of distribution, not being able to be benefited through the parents patriae actions. And that is true to an extent, except where the benefit is a Cypre recovery that benefits the whole of the state. I would suggest there is some benefit to the business interest. And moreover, you don't see the business representatives, NFIB or AOI, in here testifying in favor of this bill. And if they really felt that we needed to have an expansion of indirect purchaser standing, I think you would see that. And as Mr. Holt will testify, AOI maintains its opposition to this bill. With that, why don't I open up for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Smith.
Thanks very much. Thanks for testimony. Have we heard from the Attorney General? Is this something that he wants to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't believe we have. I think that we certainly would want to encourage the Attorney General to take an activist role in this area. And I would be very surprised if our new Attorney General did not take an activist role in this particular arena.
But we, do we have any indication from the Attorney General that he's suggesting that this would somehow limit the Attorney General's motivation to be that activist if this went forward? Do we have any indication that he wants this expanded workload?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we do not, and I wouldn't
That's
suggest
helpful,
that. I would suggest simply that we're likely to, hopefully, likely to see a good level of activism.
Thanks.
Mr. Gardner, we heard testimony from Mr. Albertine that indicated the Attorney General doesn't have the staff, and then we heard a question from Co-Chair of the Public Safety and Ways and Means, Representative Shields, who pointed out that they're in this budget thing, and he's looking very closely at the Attorney General's budget, that there may well be a lack of funds for the Attorney General, and so I just would ask, how would you...
Mr. Chair, under a SAG agreement, the private attorney can be compensated in a contingent fee arrangement. So the attorney essentially gets paid only if he or she wins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate your point, but at the end of the day, the staff at the in the Attorney General's office can't wait until the settlement is complete before they actually get attorney's fees. We've got to pay their salary during that time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I don't think I made myself clear. What I'm suggesting is under a special Attorney General agreement, if that's negotiated, it can say, you, Mr. Special Attorney, Andy Aubertine, I'll use this as an example, you'll only get paid if you win. So it's a classic, you know, contingent fee arrangement.
And follow up, Mr. So do you, in that particular arrangement, do you feel that there's no cost at all to the Department of Justice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, there would be administrative costs for entering into that agreement, under that Special Attorney General agreement, but there could well be compensating benefit if the lawsuit were successful. Could be a revenue source.
You have any idea how often that type of arrangement, contingent fee SAG, is used?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I don't right now. It was fairly infrequent with Hardy Myers. In other states, it's been very frequent. So it really depends upon the kind of preference and approach of a particular Attorney General?
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't it be accurate, when you say administrative costs, I mean, when you say that and how you say that, it almost sounds like you're trying to minimize what the costs involved might be. Potentially, these could be, the quote-unquote administrative costs could be quite extensive, depending on the size of the antitrust suit, depending on the intricacies, what we're talking about as far as the products, the price fixing plan. I mean, there could be enormous potential administrative costs involved.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, that is true, and there also could be potential rewards to the state in terms of a successful recovery, which could translate into a Cypre award, say, to a worthy charity like the food bank. So costs could be, I would say they certainly would not be trivial, but the rewards to the state could be very significant.
Mr. Gardner, is it in your mind, is it preferable to leave this just sitting with in the AG's office as the only route to pursuing these kind of indirect purchaser kind of antitrust lawsuits rather than afford the ability to the private consumer?
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, I'd like to see what the track record is perhaps over the next couple of years and just see how activist an approach is taken. Because I think there are compensating benefits in terms of consolidating these in a public official acting on behalf of the citizens of the state as a whole or an injured class of consumers. I think there are, and the state, I think, maybe can benefit from that approach, as I mentioned, because of the CyPray kinds of awards that really are not. I mean, it is possible to have those in private litigation, but the couponing approach is much more likely.
And final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Right, please.
So, essentially, then it would be your testimony. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I just want to be sure I'm clear on this: that the last 8 years are not a good indication of how often the Attorney General would choose to pursue these types of lawsuits.
Chair Barker, Representative Stiegler, that's correct.
Okay.
Chair Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, just by way of background, Mr. Gardner talked about the administrative costs associated with an antitrust litigation. It is truly awesome. I am aware of no more complex area of law than antitrust. An antitrust case, even a fairly routine one, cannot be done on the cheap. It is extremely complicated. And I think Mr. Gardner has done a very good job of articulating why it is our new Attorney General should contemplate frequent use of special Attorney Generals and being more aggressive in enforcement. I agree with you entirely. That said, I respectfully, I don't think that argument in any way, shape, or form is an argument against this bill. I actually think that this bill is an additional tool to complement the Attorney General's hopefully increased enforcement. We've waited 8 years. I think this is an entirely appropriate step, and I think the risks of duplicative litigation and duplicative recovery in particular, for the reasons the proponents spoke to, are very unlikely.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this being my second time around on the public safety sub, I can assure you that the committee has encouraged Attorney General Myers to be very aggressive in this, and he's assured us that he has been as aggressive as he possibly could be given his resources.
Mr. Holt.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition in opposition to the bill as presented. Mr. Gardner has been very thorough in his analysis of the issue, so I just want to touch on a couple of key points. In all respect to the proponents, we do see the multiple layers as an invitation to great multipliers of damages for one action and almost without limit, depending on how long the distribution chain may be. We heard from the proponents that there is supposedly no remedy for the retailer or the consumer, but in fact there is, because there is not a pass-through defense if one is a participant in an antitrust conspiracy and by virtue of passing through the increased cost from that. That is not a defense against damages, and so the consumer or the retailer does in fact have remedy against the next folks up the chain. In regard to the state's interest here, we would concur with Mr. Gardner's analysis that the state in many ways can benefit by keeping these things consolidated in the Attorney General's office. The fact that the Attorney General can contract out to antitrust experts through agreements that can minimize the upfront costs leaves the AG with lots of flexibility. But I think it also requires the Attorney General to be somewhat selective and not necessarily jump onto every potential antitrust case that comes along and exercise prosecutorial discretion in a way that is very appropriate, so that the most worthy cases do get pursued on behalf of the people of Oregon. And with that, I just wanted to add that it was communicated to me just before the hearing. J.L. Wilson from Associated Oregon Industries could not be here. They are a member of our coalition and wanted to be on record that they are also opposed to the bill.
Representative Garrett.
Tom, the remedy you mentioned that an indirect purchaser has against the next person up the chain, how does that work?
If you were, say, a retailer, Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, if you're a retailer, then you would have action against the wholesaler and so on.
Well, what action is that?
That would be in relation to antitrust, yep. Is my understanding.
Mr. Chairman, may I jump in there? And I can furnish the I suspect some members of the committee have already read these decisions, but the federal decision in Illinois Brick and its predecessor case, the Shoe case, which established that there's no pass-on defense, that was the premise for the Illinois Brick decision that said only, and it was precisely for the because the U.S. Supreme Court said there is a risk of duplicative recovery. So, but I think the best way to sort of answer that question might be to distribute to the committee the copies of those two decisions.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think I have a higher tolerance for reading case law than most on this committee. Illinois Brick is a punishing decision. It was about 50 pages. I quit after about page 12. But with that said, go, by all means, go ahead. I'm sure my committee members will tear into it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, if you just read the summaries on both of those, it'll give you a pretty good idea of Shoe case says no pass on defense. Illinois Brick says because of Shoe, you can't have stack up the recoveries, only direct purchasers. So that's how we all got to this point in the state of the law. I should add that, by the way, that's still a federal case law.
Okay, just a question that keeps recurring to me. We had testimony that I, as a purchaser, I buy the same vitamins my sister-in-law, who lives in Vancouver, buys. She gets $294 back, and I get $27 back. If we pass this law, I would have a shot at getting the $290 or whatever it was.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, but everybody up, you would be able to, the manufacturer could be sued by everybody up and down the chain of distribution. So it's a balancing question. I mean, it really is the balance that we struck in 2001 was to essentially have that kind of indirect purchaser recovery inure to the benefit of the citizenry as a whole through the parents patriae power of the Attorney General, rather than sending coupons out to the individuals. But you're absolutely right. There is a balancing question, and really the purpose of my testimony today is to just alert you to the fact that it's not just single-sided issue. There is a real concern about duplicative recovery.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. But Mr. Gardner, we heard testimony from Mr. Albertine that in reality, the way these litigations occur is that they are typically consolidated and really managed by the court system in a way that truly mitigates the risk of duplicative recoveries. So do you disagree with that just as a factual matter? And if you do, do you have data or some evidence that we can look at to help sort out that factual question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, what we actually addressed this issue during the interim group after the 2001 session, and the sort of viewpoint of people like Barnes Ellis who litigate these on the defense side was that that typically what happens, these cases settle out, and part of the settlement value is avoidance of the risk of duplicative recovery, so that it's a complex equation, but that's the best I can offer to you, and that's actually covered in that report that is discussed. That as a practical matter, defense counsel will essentially agree to a higher settlement because of that interorum effect of the if it actually were to go to trial and verdict.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you would disagree with the statement in Professor Burnett's letter quote-unquote, the primary argument against expanding standing is that there is a theoretical threat of duplicative trouble damages recovery. However, many states have granted standing to indirect purchasers since 1977, and I am not aware of any examples of duplicative recoveries.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, I think that is exactly, that's consistent with what I'm testifying, because they typically settle out. And the and that's also covered in the report by the group that Andy chaired. And what the testimony of the defense lawyers was that the settlement value reflects that risk, incorporates that risk. So I think he's correct that there are not examples that I'm aware of where the actual awards were duplicative, but that doesn't mean that there's not an economic effect of that duplication, of that threat of duplication. It's sort of like, you know, the
follow-up, Mr. Chair. That's the risk involved in any of these kind of cases.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, and that's the risk we sought to minimize by doing it this way in 2001.
My point is, Mr. Gardner, that in any kind of plaintiff kind of case, in a lot of it, not only antitrust arena, but a lot of different other arenas, there are risks involved potentially of other lawsuits, of trouble damages, that kind of thing, but we don't keep those laws off the book because of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, in federal court, we do limit recovery of treble damages to direct purchasers, and we do it according to the rationale of the Illinois Brick case, precisely to mitigate the risk of duplicative recoveries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, Mr. Gardner, I guess I should have, this is referring to the chart, and I realize that what other states do, that's not, shouldn't be our bottom line, but from the data that's been presented to us from other states, as a non-legal professional, this bill is giving full repealer status with indirect purchase standing and triple damages, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please.
Okay, so the data that was presented to us by other states show that 17 states have that law. Six have the partial repealer states of indirect purchaser standing and single damages and restitution. Nine are like Oregon and Washington, Utah and Idaho with the Attorney General remedy only. And 10 states do not address this. And those are pretty significant states, Virginia, Massachusetts, New Jersey. Why, you know, has this been an issue? Do you know if that's been an issue in those states and why they have not pursued this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I really don't know the history in all of those states. It has been early on after the Illinois BRIC decision was handed down, NAG, the National Association of Attorney Generals, took a very activist approach in attempting to push repealer statutes. Then it sort of quieted down, and you know, so it's been kind of a patchwork. I don't really have a better answer than that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
So I think you just said, wait, the National Association of Attorney Generals was pushing four repealer statutes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's my understanding. Right early on after Illinois BRIC was handed down.
Which suggests to me that it is a prodigiously thin reed upon which to rest our dissent from this law that attorney generals should be eager to do all of the work instead of any private attorneys general.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think that was the early reaction of NAG. And I think there are certainly arguments in favor of the private attorney general function. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
What I'm suggesting is that there are some countervailing issues that you should consider.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just say, and we've had a lot of discussion about this, and I expect there may be more. The only other thing that has yet to be brought up is I would be curious with data provided by either proponents or opponents after this hearing or whenever, maybe by testimony, of what percentage of cases where there is a violation of antitrust law do we think, know, estimate, are actually brought? My guess is it's a relatively small portion of when compared to the number of potential violations. And so, at least for me, even as I think we do want to make sure our business climate is intelligent, et cetera, I would want to include that in our analysis of who we allow and who we empower to enforce what might be a relatively or unrelatively low enforced point of law.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just comment on this. That I want to be clear that the folks that I represent do support vigorous enforcement of the antitrust laws and do support the role of the private right of action, but feel that there's a balance that needs to be struck. And I think your question's entirely appropriate, Representative Smith.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Gardner, I'd ask that you do provide at least summaries of those cases, and we'll do a little further study. I hear questions in the panel, in the committee's questions that aren't answered, so we might take a little further look at this, and we'll contact the AG's office.
Will do, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2584, and open a public hearing on House Bill 2585.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2585 repeals the prohibition on class actions for unlawful trade practices, Truth in Lending Act, and similar lawsuits. It applies retroactively unless a judgment was entered before the date of enactment. It declares emergency effective on passage. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just have more free. Okay. Stoley? Stoley. Whitelaw. Hey, Mr. Reynolds, Mr. Whitelaw, and Mr. Stoll, please. Identify yourself for the record as it is recorded. And I'm going to ask that we kind of try to concentrate or compress a little bit because we do have one more matter before the committee before.
I'm Jason Reynolds, Executive Director of the Consumer Justice Alliance, and I'm here to talk briefly about my support of House Bill 2585.
And I don't mean to cut you short either. You need to say what you need to say.
Okay.
That's fine. But
I've protected consumers for 12 years or more. And the cases that are most frustrating for me are the small cases where there's damages of less than $100, $50, $25. The individual consumer can go to court and get a $200 statutory damage. But if I have 10 of them, there's no class thing. I can't refer them all together to an attorney. They can only then sue for the actual damages, which may be minimal. The other remedies are that the person go to small claims court, but it's not for very much money, and it costs you to file, and it's lots of people scared of it. Or the attorney general could take up a case of 30 or 40 of these cases that don't amount to $1,000, which is unrealistic. So small con artists have a field day in Oregon because there's really no effective way to stop them. And I think this bill does stop them. And that's why I'm in favor of it. I will now refer. These people know more than I do. Thanks.
I'm Robert Stoll. I'm a retired attorney from Portland. And I'm here to testify in favor of 2585. As Mr. Reynolds indicated, when there's small damages in a consumer fraud case, there is a provision in the Unlawful Trade Practice Act for $200 minimum damages. When the class action laws were enacted in Oregon in the late 70s, compromise was arranged. And the bringing minimum statutory damage actions as class actions was specifically prohibited as a as part of the deal, so to speak, to get the class action statute. It's a very unique provision in our law. The problem is that this combination of the prohibition of bringing class actions for the minimum damages results essentially in gutting the original intent of class actions, because in the, if a crook defrauds hundreds or thousands of consumers, the typical response would, individually in a small amount, the individual doesn't have the either the incentive to bring the law enforcement action, or either for himself or for others, and can't do it for others because he's prohibited from bringing a class action. So this changes that and permits a class action for those minimum statutory damages. And the example I gave in my written submission is of the travel. Let's say there was a crooked travel agent that was creating an overcharge of, let's say, 2.5% that it called a tax recovery fee. And that may be a small, too small potatoes for the consumer. In other words, they'd have to buy $1,000 worth of airplane tickets to even get to $200. But if you're handling thousands and thousands of transactions as a travel agent, if it's an internet travel agent, something like that, it could be millions of dollars. And so those people, two things are happening there. One is there's no law enforcement of in that instance. It's my understanding from the Attorney General there's like 90,000 a year of consumer complaints. So the Attorney General's got his hands full as it is, just sort of sorting through the paper, let alone bringing actions. And then the consumer is ripped off, and maybe it's only a few hundred dollars, but the fact of the matter is they're being ripped off, and there's no redress in Oregon as a practical matter for those people.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Ed Whitelaw. I have some written comments from a colleague of mine, Dr. Ward, in our Portland office. I'll refer to Auer in a minute. I've been teaching at the University of Oregon since 1967. I started an economic and financial consulting firm in my basement in 1974. We now have roughly 50 people, and about 20%, 20 to 25% of our revenues are from litigation support of one kind or another. I've been involved in the class action, ADM, for example, on the plaintiff side. Next week I testify in New York on a multi-district litigation. But I want to focus right now just on the on the minutiae of a class action or small claims. If an expert is warranted, I will try to describe how we've been involved in class actions in which we would have to assemble the individual handwritten receipts for a small claim for just one individual. And I trust you understand the logic of class action has something to do with exploiting the economies of scale and scope, and thereby make the case easier to handle, both for the court and for the parties. The difficulty with this kind of small claims issue from, say, the expert side is just assembling the record so that it will withstand scrutiny and challenge for handwritten receipts for small claims is time-consuming. So you don't make it up with volume. Each one is costly to assemble, so that the law as it stands, in effect, enables fraud imposed on smaller claims. I think that's enough for my comments.
Okay, thank you. So if I'm understanding this right, and I think I've talked with somebody else about this earlier, at the present time, if somebody cheats 100 people out of $25, it's $2,500. So under this, you would have to go to $200 minimum on your class action. So that would boost that to $40,000 from $2,500. And is there some, I mean, does that tip a scale too far on some of the smaller amounts?
Well, I would suggest that if there's a crook, he's a crook. I mean, it's not. This is not a situation where somebody's doing lawful. This is not negligence. This is not somebody being lazy or something of that nature. This is a person doing fraudulent activity. You got to. You still have to prove there was fraudulent activity. So there's got to be liability, first of all. And you could say, yes, there's $25. The person, you've got, did you say 100 people? 100 people. You've got 100 people. You're going to have a, you could say that all these people are going to get a windfall. I mean, that's, you can say that's one way of looking at it. In the wisdom of the legislature, at some point in time, we decided we were going to have minimum damages. I would suggest to you, though, that it's not just claims that are less than $200. It's claims that are hundreds, maybe even thousands of dollars, that the cost of hiring Mr. Whitelaw or some other economist to go through the records and figure out what the overcharge or whatever, what the fraudulent charge was, is not economic. And so as a consequence, you have, unless you can, you have a really large claim, you don't see, you know, unless it is absolutely simple to do the calculation, you're not going to get, you're not going to get a recovery. I mean, my example of the 2.5% with the, if it was charged on airline tickets and nothing else, you'd have to go through that customer's receipts to see what he paid for airplane tickets versus what he paid for hotels or what he paid for, you know, other things, and that would be a very time-consuming operation. It basically makes it inoperable. The way this bill sort of started rolling was that actually I went to a continuing education and somebody from the Attorney General's office was explaining the frustration of not being able to, you know, to bring these cases because of the volume that they have.
Well, and I know many people are frustrated not only in a class action matter, but you can't, I mean, if I have somebody has cheated me out of some money, I can't hire an attorney. By the time we go to the court, I've spent more than they, you know, than they cheated me in all those difficulties.
I thought we were very reasonable.
Yeah. even a 400 an hour, anyway, which is...
Let me try to contrast, just again to bring home the point I made earlier. In the ADM case, we had electronic data from all the companies. It wasn't just ADM. It was Cargill and a bunch of them. We had hundreds of thousands of transactions on big databases spread over years. But they were electronic. And granted, we had to tidy up, you know, Cargill versus ADM and so on, but it was manageable, and clearly the scale economies paid. Now, come down to a shoebox or, you know, a dusty attic or something like that in which you've got these records that are scattered around and you're trying to piece them together in an internally consistent description of what the hell was going on. I mean, the unit cost per claim is considerable, and so that's part of what's going on here. It's not just the number of transactions or the individual, but it's the nature of these small charges. They are obscure. They can, you know, a single individual might have 100, 200, 300 during the year and never know it. So,
and I'm thinking of too, a recent case that was settled, legal aid settled, a case where somebody, a renter or a rental company or something, had been clipping people for a water charge that wasn't
exactly
real,
yeah.
And it took them 8 years to settle.
Right.
Yeah, Representative
Mr. Chair
Krieger.
Mr. Stahl, on page 3, section 6, line 13, causes of action, whether arising before, on, or after the effective date of this 209 Act. What's
the before, what does that mean? I mean, how far back? Is there a statute of limitations, or what is there?
I think that that was put in by legislative council. I think that that, you mean the UTPA, how far back does UTPA go?
Yeah, because it's right in the bill, Section 6.
I'm pretty sure it's 2 years.
Yeah.
I don't have...
They're saying something.
2 years, though.
So.
2 years. It's 2 years from the date.
It's 2 years, Mr. Chair. I'm just
trying to catch up with the question.
We're not going to have a situation. You're not going to have a situation where somebody's been sitting on this for years.
But it is retroactive.
Is 200, I'm wondering about the number $200, the $200 minimum in some cases where that seems like that could be excessive. I understand all the work that would have to go into that, but might that be too high on a small amount? I mean, if everybody's cheated a small amount, the 1% or something on their airline
well,
ticket.
Well, I would suggest to you that, again, if it's, I mean, I don't know, but the person is a crook.
Yeah.
You find them, you send them to jail. Usually, this is which is more than the $200, or you know, for the $25. I don't. I'm unaware of the case where there was a 25. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't exist.
Sure.
It probably does exist. Where there was 25, person was cheated out of $25 and had to pay $200. I think that the economics of massive fraud. My firm does a lot of securities litigation. And the amount of massive fraud there, I mean, when you get into these fraud cases, people are not talking usually about $25.
Yeah. Okay.
They're even on an individual basis.
Thank you. Anybody else? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stoll, thank you for coming in particular. I've always wanted to, you know, kind of be able to question you. I always figured it would be actually in a, as a witness in cross-examination. But, so
that?
I'm actually wondering where 32K comes from. And it strikes me as utterly odd. I believe the federal rule would be Rule 23, would be the Oregon equivalent, the equivalent of Oregon Rule 32. And of course, there being no equivalent, do any other states have this, or is this just
there's
a bizarre quirk?
States, there's actually two states that have an identical provision in their rules of civil procedure, Iowa and North Dakota.
Well, Mr. Stoll, thank you for bringing this to my attention as well as this body.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Gardner, Mr. Holt, and looks like Mr. Cosgrove, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've agreed that I can go first, if that's all right with
Please.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Service Association, one of the members of the United Financial Lobby. And I would just like to make a couple of comments about why we oppose House Bill 2585. Financial services organizations, generally speaking, are not subject to the Uniform Trade Unlawful Trade Practices Act, except in the case in which we buy retail installment contracts from car dealers or other kinds of folks who finance through retail installment contracts, in which case the claims against those dealers actually pass through to us as the financial institution. We are, however, the group of people who are subject to claims under the Truth in Lending Act, which is the second act mentioned in your summary and is the federal legal citation that exists in 32K. And I'd like to briefly read that section to you. A class action may not be maintained for the recovery of statutory minimum penalties for any class member as provided in, and then there's citations to Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the Federal Truth in Lending Act, and it further says, or any similar statute. Truth in lending financial institution liability is a very difficult thing for us, partly because it is a highly technical federal statute. There are lots of ways to unintentionally violate the Truth in Lending Act. There is no fraudulent requirement, no fraudulent or willful requirement under the Truth in Lending Act, a negligent violation is a violation. And you heard about $200 statutory damages. Under Truth in Lending Act, it's $1,000. We have just seen the most dramatic expansion of the Truth in Lending Act for years since it was passed in the 70s. Roughly 50 pages of new federal regulations amending and expanding the Truth in Lending Act have been passed effective this July 1st, 2009, dealing with a variety of mortgage lending practices that, in addition to the technical, mathematical requirements of the pre-existing Truth in Lending Act that you're probably even familiar with, the federal box that says your annual percentage rate and your finance charge, there are now a whole series of judgmental requirements in the Act. Have we adequately determined the person's ability to pay on a particular mortgage? As you might imagine, the thought to a small financial institution, and some of my members are small local Oregon-based companies, as are some of our community banks and community credit unions, of course, of a major class action when you're facing not only attorney's fees and costs, which are always available under all of these consumer protection acts, but also multiple times $1,000 statutory damages, is of great concern. That's the reason that we oppose removal of ORCP 32K. I want to make sure that you also highlight that the issue of whether these cases are economical to bring, even with small amounts, is generally speaking taken care of by the fact that they are, in fact, even if your recovery is only $10 or $15, all of the reasonable attorney's fees and costs, of course, are added on top of that. So this is not a question, as it happens in some kinds of legal cases, where a small claim against somebody won't be brought because the amount you'd spend on attorney's fees and costs would chew it up many times over. And then lastly, there was talk about fraud and fraudulent crooks. I'd just like to point out that under Oregon's current case law and statute, the requirement under the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act is that the act be willful, but the courts have been absolutely clear that willful under that act means negligent. You can be in violation of Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act when you have been negligent without being fraudulent. So it is a concern to a number of other businesses as well. I'd be glad to happy to answer any questions.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove. First of all, I do understand your concerns. However, I want to push back and see what you think. But keep in mind, this bill will only affect class actions. This will only, is such that if in any negligence tends to be, not always, but tends to be sort of an individual case. But so in order for a class to be certified and actually bring a class action against a financial institution for negligent violation of the Truth in Lending Act, there would have to be a common nucleus of facts and law, and such that it would have to be an institution systematically, by its very practice, violating the act, in which case actually pretty harsh recovery might be in order. Indeed, I would think that this bill would deter such faulty practices from ever happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, let me give you a non-financial institution example for which I'm fully aware of a negligent act that in fact would have been a willful violation under Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act that I don't think raises to the level that you are suggesting. One of my other clients, which runs health clubs, athletic facilities. There's a whole series of requirements in Oregon law that have to be in their contracts. By mistake, a variety of contracts were shipped to some of the Portland area branches of this health club that were complete compliance with the law of the state of Texas, not Oregon. Literally hundreds of consumers signed contracts that were in technical violation of Oregon law, in that Oregon's law has a different set of disclosures in a different order than Texas's law. I would suggest to you that that is one willful under the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act, under as currently found by the courts, but not particularly rising to the level that you are discussing of a truly bad actor. Yet under this provision, even if there was no ascertainable loss by any one of those customers, they could join in a class action and sue for $200 times the number of people in the class plus attorney's fees and costs. That's the kind of recovery concern that we have.
Just a brief follow-up. Thank you for that, and that certainly applies to Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. However, of course, the Truth in Lending Act being a federal act would be uniform. I think my point still applies there. But I understand the response.
Mr. Chairman, I could give you an example. The same kind of example exists under the Truth in Lending Act. The numbers of disclosures and the possibility of making an unintentional error in your procedures for processing loans or determining that you have met all the standards, especially in the new Truth in Lending Act, you could easily have a negligent, non-willful, non-fraudulent violation on a systematic basis of a number of loans and be subject to a number of $1,000 recoveries. It's the concern we have about the bill.
Do you see recoveries like that, though? I mean, I would assume if I was the judge in that case, I'd say, you know, they made a mistake, you're not hurt.
Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, under both of those acts as written, the judge doesn't have any authority to reduce the minimum statutory damages. They're always written to be your actual damages or $200 in the case of the Oregon Act, $1,000 in case of Truth in Lending, whichever is greater. So there is no ability for mitigation of those damages in those kinds of cases.
Question in response to Mr. Stoll's testimony that we are, I think, with only two other states in having a bar on class actions. It was unclear to me. Is that also, do you know, is that true for financial institutions as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gary, I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that question, and I will try to see if I can confirm that.
I would like to know, I'm always interested in these bills, where we fit with the national framework of regulation.
I'm just not sure. I'll try to find out, though.
Okay. It just occurred to me, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cosgrove, the Truth in Lending Act, of course, being a federal act, actually has a federal remedy. It has a federal right of action. And, of course, the FRCPs don't have any equivalent to 32K, such that actually I think the liability would already exist in federal courts. So I don't think your clients actually would be exposed to new liability as a result of this action, would they? So much as they would be exposed in Oregon. The plaintiff could bring it in an Oregon court instead of federal court.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, you're correct. A plaintiff could bring a federal class action against a financial institution and seek that kind of recovery. Generally speaking, however, these cases, in my experience, which is anecdotal, I will assure you, are often brought in state court and where 32K does apply. And it's done that for a variety of reasons. A state court is often more convenient, quicker, right, more familiar to litigants, and therefore these cases that I have seen have been primarily in state court.
So, one brief follow-up. So to clarify, repealing 32K will not expose your clients to new liability under the Truth in Lending Act.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, it will subject us to liability in a greater number of cases. That's correct. I think that's the appropriate way to
In a different venue is how I would phrase it, but not new liability per se.
Mr. Holt, and again, we're not going to work this today.
Sorry.
So
yeah.
I would ask, because we have one more matter we have to.
Yes, I'll be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again for the record, Tom Holt on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, in appearing in opposition to House Bill 2585. This bill is a very significant policy change to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act by way of this change of seemingly arcane procedure. It's important to bear in mind that the UTPA was written with these statutes, whether here or elsewhere, are very technical in nature, and ours was written with a balance in mind of this particular procedure. And so removing this procedural requirement as it relates to the financial sector would very much upset the balance and invite more litigation, we believe. And what we have observed is that in effect, what you're doing here is creating a private attorney general And where that exists, it can often result in attempts to create policy via litigation that the legislature itself may decline to engage. And we think those matters more properly belong before legislature and through bodies such as this committee. We believe it would raise litigation costs for business and also raise defense costs because mistakes would be higher. And I think otherwise, Mr. Cosgrove has done an excellent job of summarizing, so I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Gardner for Pharma again. I'll be very brief. This is a kind of a curious provision, it's an important provision. It's substantive. The reason this is before you instead of the Council on Court Procedures is because it's considered to be sufficiently of sufficient magnitude that it is substantive, not procedural. And so with that in mind, a question I would urge you to ask is what on earth the phrase similar statutes means? Does that mean any statute that contains a liquidated damages provision of any magnitude? Because there are, I believe, federal statutes and maybe state statutes that have pretty hefty liquidated damages provisions in them, civil penalties, that sort of thing. So I think that's something that would be, it's an ambiguity that's in the existing law, but it has new and fresh urgency were you to take this action. So I would urge you to try to figure out exactly what that phrase means, because I haven't a clue.
Okay. With that, I'm going to, before I close the hearing, I'm going to ask Mr. Gardner that you possibly get together with Representative Barton and Garrett, who have some expertise in this line of work, and take another look at this and see where we are.
Okay.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2585. I know I'm not calling it a work group either.
Those get a little too big.
Time for your birthday.
That's right. He's not the only birthday guy that happened.
Another birthday. Another birthday in the House. Open a work session on House Bill 2163.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2163 comes at the request of the Oregon Military Department. What the bill does is establish that appeals from the Armed Services Court of Appeals for the Oregon go directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. And there's other matters as it relates to the Judge Advocacy Corps. The amendments that you have in front of you, the dash one amendments, and they go over to page 3, delete lines 26 and 27, and insert a party agreed by decision of the Armed Services Court of Appeals for Oregon may petition the Supreme Court of the state for review within 35 days after the date of the decision in the manner provided by the rules of the Supreme Court.
Representative Wisnan,
move the dash ones in the House Bill 2163.
Representative Wisnan moves the dash ones in the House Bill 2163. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I assume that counsel is king for the day, so we don't even have to do anything formally here, do we?
Chair, members of the committee, I have my wife's permission to say that, yes.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee's pass House Bill 2163-1 to the floor of a due pass recommendation and wish Mr. Taylor happy birthday.
Thank you. Representative Wisnap moves House Bill 2163 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Excuse.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Stiegler?
Excused.
Vice Chair Wisnap?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I ask Representative Wisnap to carry that.
Thank you.
Carry bill.
Thank you.
I'm a little bit older than you,
61. Run away to a meeting?
29.
Spit bill will be in concert with